Welcome. We're going to study 1st and 2nd Chronicles 17 through 36 today. So we'll cover the last part of this series on this book. Again, the overarching concern for the book of 1st and 2nd Chronicles is restoration. This is written to the people who are going back into the land after the Babylonian exile. After the Babylonian Empire, you had the Persian Empire, and King Cyrus had an edict that allowed the Israelites to return back into the land in 538 BC and go and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And so this book is written to that group of people that are going back to restore the temple, and they have some other things that they want to get accomplished. They need to restore the Davidic monarchy, so they need to get a king reestablished. They need to get the temple rebuilt. They need to get worship reinstituted in the life of the temple, so that means they're going to need the priesthood operating and functioning back in its fullness again. And they also want to get the prophetic ministry reestablished. In ancient Israel, there were three ordained offices, or you may want to think of them as messianic offices, three anointed offices: the prophet, the priest, and the king. All three of those offices are critical. And as we go through this particular section of the book, you'll see the interplay of the prophet, the priest, and the king in the way that Israel is faithful or unfaithful to the Lord. And I should say Judah, just to be clear. We're talking about the southern kingdom through the book of Chronicles. The chronicler focuses on the southern kingdom almost to the exclusion of the northern kingdom. We get some discussion of the northern kingdom, but it's always in relationship or from the perspective of the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom is the enemy that's attacking. It's corrupt. It's an unholy alliance, as we'll see. But the perspective of the chronicler is to reestablish the kingdom, the southern kingdom, particularly the line of David and the city of Jerusalem and the tribe of Judah. And so this book is actually giving a bit of a blueprint to that restored people. We are in the section focused on the divided kingdom. After David and Solomon, the kingdom split to that northern and southern kingdom. And so we're in the section, chapters 10 through 28, where the divided kingdom takes place. Let's begin with chapter 17, and we're looking at the reign of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat is seen as a faithful king for the tribe and for the kingdom for the most part. That's why I said all is well except. He's a pretty good guy. Beginning in chapter 17, 2 Chronicles 17, Jehoshaphat his son reigned in his place and strengthened himself against Israel. He placed forces in all the fortified cities of Judah, set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim that Asa his father had captured. The Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the earlier ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals. Now, that's the first time in Chronicles that Baal is mentioned. And it's going to come into play in this particular section, because Jehoshaphat is going to have an interaction with the wicked king Ahab to the north. And he will actually make an alliance with King Ahab. But King Ahab is famous for setting up Baal altars and for sacrificing children to the false god Baal. And so Jehoshaphat didn't do that, and that's why he's commended. But the problem that he has is that he's connecting himself to somebody who is. That's the all is well except for Jehoshaphat's reign. For the most part, he does some great things and does positive things. He strengthens the kingdom of Israel militarily. You see that in the establishing of those garrisons. He also does some very good spiritual things. He removes the high places. Look at verse 6. His heart was courageous in the ways of the Lord, and furthermore, he took the high places in the Asherim out of Judah. Remember, the high places are the place where Israelites had set up altars to false gods and were worshiping and serving Ashtoreth, who's like the movie star goddess of the ancient Near East. Baal's like the man god. Ashtoreth is the sexy movie star goddess. All bad. She is just kind of voluptuous and...
Are those our idols of today, movie stars?
Well, we still focus on fertility gods. We still focus on the cash cow. We use the language of idolatry when we talk about money. You know, that's a cash cow. That's a bull market. What are we doing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you never thought about that, huh? We can't get away from our false gods. All an idol is the work of our hands and the delight of our hearts on anything other than God. And so whatever you make the center of your life other than Jesus is an idol. And for most people, that is their job or their appearance or their fertility, their children, their sexuality. I mean, all these things, they haven't changed. They're the same things that have continually distracted humanity ever since the beginning. And, you know, they come in different forms and shapes and sizes, but they're the same gods. So Jehoshaphat is reforming both spiritually and strengthening militarily, and he does not seek after those false gods, the Baals. One of the things that he does is he sends teachers of the law out through the land to instruct the people. And this is just a really great thing. Look at verse 7. He, in the third year of his reign, he sent officials, and he lists the different officials, to teach in the cities of Judah. Verse 9, and they taught in Judah, having the book of the law of the Lord with them. And they went about through all the cities of Judah and taught among the people. It's a great thing. No biblical illiteracy in Judah. People are going to learn the scriptures, and they're going to know it. And what that seems to do is have its desired effect. Look at verse 10. And the fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms of the lands that were around Judah, and they made no war against Jehoshaphat. So the military strengthening, the spiritual strengthening, the word of the Lord being in the minds and hearts of the people, Judah becomes quite strong. And they're having a good season. Except, chapter 18. Now Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he made a marriage alliance with Ahab. After some years, he went down to Ahab in Samaria. Now it's interesting, you see that where it says he went down? He's actually going north, but it means he went down because he goes down from the mountain of Jerusalem. It's a road, you have to go down the road, so it's more about vertically down than directionally down. Okay? It's just it's a figure of speech. So he went down to Ahab in Samaria, and Ahab killed an abundance of sheep and oxen for him, and the people were with him and induced him to go up against Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab, king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, "Will you go with me to Ramoth-Gilead?" And he answered him, "I am as you are, my people as your people. We will be with you in the war." So they make a military alliance here, and they make a marriage alliance. Now that's going to have some negative implications. And Jehoshaphat is faithful even in that alliance, but we start to see where that unholy alliance, you can't be unequally yoked, is what Paul says in Corinthians. And Jehoshaphat wants to inquire of the word of the Lord, but Ahab doesn't like the prophets of the Lord. They never tell him what he likes. Look at verse 7. The king of Israel says to Jehoshaphat, "There's yet one man by whom we may inquire of Yahweh, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, but I hate him. For he never prophesies good concerning me, always evil." I wonder why. But he doesn't want to hear him. But they bring Micaiah because Jehoshaphat wants to hear from him. And of course, Micaiah says, "As the Lord lives, this is verse 13, as the Lord lives, what my God says, I will speak." So I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. I'm not going to tell you what your prophets like to tell you. I'm not going to give you anything other than what God tells me to tell you. And of course, Micaiah prophesies the destruction of the king of Israel. And that's, again, why he is not looked favorably upon by Ahab. He prophesies that Ahab is going to come to disaster. Now, one of the things that Jehoshaphat is confronted with is by another prophet. Hanani the seer. If you look at chapter 19, verse 1, you see that the alliance that Jehoshaphat had made with Ahab was an unholy alliance, that this was not something that pleased the Lord. Jehu said, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Because of this, wrath has gone out against you from the Lord." So in spite of all the good things that he had done, this unholy alliance that he made where he helped a wicked king, Ahab, and loved somebody who hates God, and he is going to come under judgment. But there's a mitigation of God's judgment against Jehoshaphat. Nevertheless, some good is found in you. For you destroyed Asheroth out of the land and have set your heart to seek God. So it's going to be a delayed judgment that comes on Jehoshaphat's line. And it will actually come in the form of his children. Some of the other good things that Jehoshaphat did is he appointed a court system using the Levites and priests and heads of families. He established a system of judgment so that there could be justice throughout the land. So he was, as a ruler, a good guy, except for that one little thing, that alliance. Overall, he believed the prophets and trusted them, even when they told him bad things, like Jehu just did as an example. So what's the negative fruit that the judgment of God bears? It comes in the next three kings of Israel. And it's essentially a direct result of that marriage alliance. Because what is the fruit of a marriage alliance? A son and a corrupt king. Jehoram is an evil person because he's married to Ahab's daughter. And he does great harm to the Davidic line. 21 verse 4, he kills all of his brothers with the sword. So essentially he is wiping out the Davidic line out of power, jealousy, and corruption, and evil. You have during the reign of Jehoram, Ahaziah, and Athaliah. Now Athaliah is actually a queen. Ahaziah is the son of Jehoram, and he does not live very long. And his mother, Athaliah, who is the daughter of Ahab, she becomes the queen of all things of Judah. And her reign is definitely marked by idolatry, treachery, and murder. And she tries to kill all of the Davidic family. She tries to wipe them all out. But there's a promise that's made to David that his line would have an heir on the throne forever. 2 Samuel chapter 7, remember that one? The Davidic covenant. So you see an allusion to that promise in 2 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 7. Yet the Lord was not willing to destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he had made with David. And since he had promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. And so providentially, the way that that was preserved is the daughter of Ahaziah steals away Joash, his son, and hides him from his wrathful mother. And she sneaks him away so that she can't kill him. She kills everybody else except for that one. Isn't that interesting? The line of David, the messianic line, the line of Jesus goes down to one heir because of the consequences of an unholy alliance, essentially. I mean, that should give us pause about the partnerships we make in life. I mean, we need to think about the unholy alliances that we might make and the fruit that those can bear. The Lord does not like when you join yourself with people who hate him and who love evil. And think about that in your business partnerships, your marriage partnerships, and everything. I mean, it's a very serious, serious matter that can only lead to negative things. But the Lord is faithful to his promise to David, and Joash is preserved. The section on the reign of Joash is actually more about the Levitical priesthood than it is about the monarchy, because it's the high priest Jehoiada who is, and I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, Jehoiada? Okay. Thank you for helping me out, my Hebrew scholars. Jehoiada? Let's call him that. Okay, and so this high priest is the model high priest. Now remember, the chronicler is writing to reestablish the Levitical priesthood as much as he is seeking to make sure that they reestablish the monarchy. And this high priest is used from a narrative standpoint to be a model. And we want to look at 2 Chronicles chapter 23, starting in verse 3. And all the assembly made a covenant with the king and the house of God. And Jehoiada said to them, "Behold the king's son, let him reign, as the Lord spoke concerning the sons of David. This is the thing you shall do. Of you priests and Levites who come off duty on the Sabbath, one-third shall be gatekeepers, one-third shall be at the king's house, one-third at the gate of the foundation, and all the people shall be in the courts of the house of the Lord. Let no one enter the house of the Lord except the priests and the ministering Levites. They may enter, for they are holy, but all the people shall keep the charge of the Lord. The Levites shall surround the king, each with his weapons in his hands, and whoever enters the house shall be put to death. Be with the king when he comes in and when he goes out." So see, this enhanced role of the Levites is to protect the last heir of David. You see that? And there he's organized them to surround the king and essentially to be royal bodyguards to protect the line of David. So you have these providential things that are happening through the ministry of key faithful leaders and faithful people, absolutely critical to the preservation of the messianic line. And so the Levites of all and all Judah did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded, and they each brought his men and were to go off duty on the Sabbath and so on. And so they crowned him the king and dealt with some of the rebels, but the emphasis is of course on the priesthood in this. When the high priest dies, look at chapter 24, verse 17. Actually, I'm going to pick up at verse 15. But Jehoiada grew old and full of days and died. He was 130 years old at his death. That's a good long run, 130. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel and toward God and his house. Now, after the death of Jehoiada, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king. Then the king listened to them, and they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. So part of what is being revealed here is how critical that priesthood and the strength of that priesthood was actually to even keeping the king accountable and in check. This is the idea of checks and balances. The priestly prophetic role has a role of preserving the monarchy, but also holding the monarchy accountable and protecting the faithfulness of the monarchy too. It's not just a matter of having a king and being a line of succession, but succession always involves a succession of faithfulness as well. We see this in church leaders too. It's not just a matter of laying hands on one bishop to the next bishop to the next bishop. We call that apostolic succession. And we want to have that unbroken chain of apostolic succession going all the way back to the first apostles. But it's also a content of faithfulness that must be passed on. The faith must be received by one generation after another. And one of the things about the leadership is leaders need accountability. It's not enough to just have your king, but the people have to hold the king accountable. And the people can be a corrupting force in the life of a king or a ruler, or they can be an accountability force. Well, here this one priest dies, and look what happens. The other princes come, and they all go downhill. Everything rots and falls apart. So what does the Lord do? Verse 19. Yet he sent prophets among them to bring them back to the Lord. So there you have the priestly role, the prophetic role. These testified against them, but they would not pay attention. Then the Spirit of God clothed Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, "Thus says God, why do you break the commandments of the Lord so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he's forsaken you." But they conspired against him, and by the command of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness that Jehoiada, Zechariah's father, had showed him, but killed his son. And when he was dying, when the prophet was dying, he said, "May the Lord see and avenge." You remember Stephen, the first deacon, when he was stoned? And he stood and he saw the Lord, the king, sitting at the right hand of the Father. And he testified against Saul and the other Jewish leaders. And one of the things that he brought up is, "Which of the prophets did you not stone?" And this just made him all the more angry. But the prophets of Israel, this was a tough job, because you had to speak the truth of God's word to those who bore the sword and had the power and authority. That's a very scary thing to do, isn't it? But that was their calling. And very more often than not, when you spoke truth to that power and authority, it got you killed. And so here this is one of the examples of a martyrdom of a prophet for being faithful to the Lord. Of course, his words still is going to be true. You can kill him, but you can't kill the word of the Lord. And just because you don't like it doesn't mean it's not going to come true. And so after they killed this prophet, the Lord raised up the army of the Syrians to come up against Joash. And they came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people and sent their spoil to the king of Damascus. And through the army of the Syrians, though the army of the Syrians had come with a few men, the Lord delivered into their hand a very great army, because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. So you see the way it works? Reject the word of the prophets, the Lord will raise up a foreign army to come in and destroy you because you're not listening. Serious stuff. So the reign of Joash is positive generally until the end, when he forsakes the Lord and becomes an example of rebellion. And you see again that interaction of the prophet. The reigns of the people that followed him, Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz, you have a kind of a mixed bag again. In the first two, Amaziah and Uzziah, they are generally faithful to the Lord, but there are certain problems in their reigns. Particularly with Amaziah, he falls to idolatry, and with Uzziah, he falls to the sin of pride. And they are confronted by prophets and priests, and you have this sort of pattern that's beginning to happen in the history here, where the kings are rebelling, they're getting prideful, they're getting idolatrous, and they get confronted by prophets and priests. Again, that's the checks and balances. Why is this an important part of the story? The reason for the fall is because we weren't paying attention to the checks and balances. We weren't guarding the monarchy, not only in its physical line, but also in its faithfulness. We weren't guarding the priesthood. We weren't guarding the prophets. And so that's the main lesson that you can learn from the history. Don't repeat that. Make sure you get these offices reestablished when you're restoring the kingdom so that they can function the way that they're supposed to. And be responsive to the Lord when he raises up a prophet. Listen to what he says. Listen to the high priesthood. These people are ordained by God. Follow a faithful king. Ultimately, the reigns of these four kings lead to a very evil one, Ahaz, who completely abandons Yahweh and the temple for false gods, and all kinds of abominable practices, and such as killing children, to sacrificing children to Baal. And he makes also more evil alliances with foreign powers. So 25 through 28 just sort of moves quickly through those four kings' reigns and makes a few points about pride and idolatry, and also Jotham, who is not given a lot of space, but he's highlighted. What the chronicler chooses to highlight about Jotham is he builds some things and does some rebuilding. And that's one of his goals, is to encourage the rebuilding of Israel and the rebuilding of the institutions and the physical structures as much as the spiritual structures. When we get to Hezekiah, this becomes a main section for the chronicler. Hezekiah is a model for restoration. Chapters 29 through 32, he gives a lot of narrative space for him, more story space than any other king since David and Solomon. He is a restorer, a reformer of right worship of Yahweh. That's the main thing that he does. He rebuilds the temple. Ahaz, the story of Ahaz ends with him locking up the doors of the temple and blocking access to the temple of the Lord. And the story of Hezekiah begins with him opening the doors of the house of the Lord and repairing the doors so that people can get back in. And he has a prayer of dedication and cleansing and restoration, lots of sacrifices, blood's flying everywhere from sacrificed animals to cleanse and restore, and lots of wonderful prayers. And he's bringing back Israel back to its right worship. He reinstitutes right celebrations and festivals. The most important festival that these restorer kings reinstitute is the Passover. That's the key one, because that's the heart of the narrative for the Israelites, for their identity. You were slaves, but God rescued you from Egypt and has brought you to this promised land. If they can get that festival back at the center of their cultic and worship life, they will again get the right heart and spirit towards the Lord. So Hezekiah brings them back to the Passover feast and Passover celebrations. And that's in chapter 29. In chapter 30, he reorganizes the leadership of the Levitical priesthood again, chapter 31. And so for all of these reforms, Israel is preserved from crisis. So when the Assyrian king Sennacherib comes right to the door of Jerusalem and threatens, he does not prevail but is sent packing because of the faithfulness of Hezekiah and his prayerfulness and his commitment to right worship. It's a huge lesson for all countries, I think. I mean, I think for our nation. If our nation would return back to right worship of the Lord, it would be more preserving of our institutional structures. But what happens in the cycle of nations is they start to get focused on other things besides the right worship of the Lord, and they get weak. Their society begins to break down, and the military strength that we have will begin to falter and fail, and ultimately can lead to some serious consequences. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can always turn back to the Lord. Remember the key verse of Chronicles: if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, then I will hear them from heaven and I will come and restore and heal their land. That is the thesis statement of the chronicler, is when people are faithful, when they seek my face, when they turn back to right worship, when they repent, I want to protect them and I want to heal their land. When they turn away, I destroy it. So Hezekiah is a model for restoration. Manasseh and Amon are an evil contrast. The interesting thing about the Manasseh story in the Chronicler is that he doesn't emphasize some of the things that are emphasized in Kings in terms of the idolatry, and he doesn't go into as much detail on all that. He does say that he did evil in the sight of the Lord. But the Chronicler, actually for Manasseh, chooses to highlight a moment where Manasseh repents and is responsive to the Lord's discipline. Take a look at chapter 33, 11 through 13. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and to his people, but they paid no attention. Therefore the Lord brought upon them commanders of the army of the king of Assyria, who captured Manasseh with hooks and bound him with chains and bronze and brought him to Babylon. And when he was in distress, he entreated the favor of the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. He prayed to him, and God was moved by his entreaty and heard his plea and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. Do you remember the theme verse that I just quoted? If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, then I will hear them and I will restore them and heal their land. See, Manasseh is a model for that. The chronicler is the one who highlights that, because that fits with what he's trying to get across to the restored Israelites. Yeah, we all fall, but the key is to repent when you fall. And even Manasseh, who is a really bad guy, he did that. And look at what happened in his life. God was even responsive to Manasseh. That's the point. Amon, no repentance with that guy. Just bad. And then we get to Josiah, who is the great reformer, and this is where 1 and 2 Kings ends. with Josiah the reformer, and they find the book of the law after Josiah is a young king, and he goes and he starts fixing up the temple, and Hilkiah comes out with the book of the law, and he says, "Hey, I think I found this in the temple. It looks important." And Josiah tears his robes, and he inquires of the prophet, "What should we do with this?" And the prophet says to Josiah, "Well, because Israel has not kept everything that is in the book of this law, exile's coming. But because you've been responsive to it, it's not going to come to you." And so Josiah continues to be a reformer like Hezekiah. He gets rid of the idolatry and the high places, restores the temple, rebuilds the temple, puts back together the priesthood, gets rid of the evil prophets and priests of the Ashtaroths and the Baals and all of the high places. The way that the book of 2 Chronicles ends is with essentially four, there's actually a fifth king in there, but Jehoaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah. These four kings are the exile kings, and they all get carted off into various places. Jehoaz and Jehoiakim end up in Egypt. I think Jehoiachin and Zedekiah end up in Babylon, and the kingdom essentially goes into exile. It's because of Zedekiah's rejections of the word of the prophet Jeremiah that ultimately leads to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in chapter 36. But the book of 2 Chronicles doesn't end with exile as the book of 2 Kings does. It ends with this little section in chapter 36, 22 to 23, which is the hope of restoration. And so I want to just show you that, because this is a difference. Look at verse 22 of the last book, last chapter, 2 Chronicles 36. And we're going to end with this. "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up." Now remember, it went down from Jerusalem. Now we go back up to Jerusalem, back up to the Mount of Zion, and we rebuild the house of the Lord. And that is where we're going next as we study the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, the history of the restoration, and all of the things that were laid out in the blueprint of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Now we've got to put them into practice as we restore the house of the Lord and the city of Jerusalem.